Hello, and welcome to Spoiler Piece Theater, the podcast that doesn't give a shit about spoilers. We just want to talk about the movies. My name is Dave Riedel. My pronouns are he, him. I write about movies, and I'm a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association.
My name is Evan Crean. I'm co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of Your 80s Movie Guide to Better Living. My pronouns are he, him.
And my name is Megan Kearns. My pronouns are she, her. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network, and I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association.
Indeed you are. I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, you are. Whatever.
I like an indeed.
Yeah, throw an indeed in there.
Mixed it up.
So before I get into the blobbity-blue about this week's episode, I thought I should mention to you, good listeners, that over on ye old Patreon... I've been on a ye old kick all night when we recorded the Patreon episode, just so everybody knows. I don't know what my problem is. But over on the Patreon, we're talking about, because we wanted to, Return of the Jedi. Yeah. Because, you know, this is Spoiler Piece, and we were talking about movies that take twists, and we're like, ooh, the twist in Empire. And then we're like, well, you can't talk about Empire because Empire is awesome. So let's talk about Jedi, because then we can really complain. So, or I can anyway. Megan and Evan had vastly different opinions than I did, and we had a very lively conversation. Yep. And
learned some things about me as a kid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We did indeed.
I want to learn more about Evan as a kid.
Yeah, I do too. But anyway, over on the Patreon page, that is up for your enjoyment. If you're a $5 patron, you have access to not free because you're paying $5 a month, but you have... You have access to bonus episodes, like there's got to be 200, 250 at this point. I don't actually know. Mm-hmm. And we do polls each month, and there's all kinds of fun stuff. And by the way, we now have merch. Yay!
Woohoo!
Yeah. So
huzzah!
If you go to our website or tpublic.com, you can find out more information about that. Mm-hmm. Yahoo, as the kids say. Anyway, this week, we're talking about three movies. We've got... Measure of Revenge. Now, I know what you're thinking. Have I heard of Measure of Revenge? No, you have not. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason. But we'll get to that. The second movie is the latest Pixar flick, Turning Red. And the last movie is the Ana de Armas, Ben Affleck, Adrian Lyne thriller, Deep Water. Although I keep wanting to call it Deep Red. I don't know why. But anyway... Let's kick things off with, I'm playing all my cards early, with Measure of Revenge. This is a movie that stars Melissa Leo, Bella Thorne, Roma Mafia in like a scene and a half, directed by Pafa, and written by Kenny, I can't actually see through my pop filter right here, so I'm not going to read the last name. Thank you. And here is... The rather long IMDb summary. Here we go. The story follows a theater actress, Lillian Cooper, that's Melissa Leo, whose son, some guy named actor whose last name is Weary, dies mysteriously. When the investigating officer rules the cause of death an accidental overdose, Lillian conducts her own investigation, which leads her to an unlikely alliance with her son's former drug dealer, Bella Thorne. On her quest for answers, Lillian hallucinates some of the iconic characters she's played on stage, which serve as her inner voice, urging her to avenge her son's death. And let me tell you, gang, if you think that sounds stupid on paper, wait till you see it on screen.
Yeah. Yep. The funny thing was, I think when we said that we wanted to see this movie, we had only known up until the last sentence of that summary of information. And then when I read that last sentence before I watched the movie, I was already groaning. I'm like, oh no, oh no, this sounds terrible now. This sounds so bad. And guess what? It's just as bad as you think it's going to be. Maybe even worse.
No, it's worse. It's worse.
This movie.
This is one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
This movie is shockingly inept. I mean, I don't know. First of all, I had to look up who Pafa is, because if you are like... doing the one name thing, you better be Madonna Louise Ciccone. You know what I'm saying? So Pafa is not the director's name. The director, I can't remember. It's one of the producers who removed his name from the movie because he was like, man, this is bullshit. So he took his name off the movie. And I don't know if it was the screenplay, his direction, or the idea that Melissa Leo was going to show up and play this character. I mean, there's scenery chewing, and then there's scenery that you rig up with TNT and you have the box and you hit the plunger and then everything explodes. Mm-hmm. That's Melissa Leo's
like
performance
Muppet
in this.
Blows everything up. The wild-eyed Muppet that likes to blow everything up.
Yeah. I mean, oh.
I don't know. You guys are making it sound a lot better than it is.
This movie is so awful that it's really hard to believe. It's really hard to believe that an Academy Award-winning performer such as Melissa Leo can be so awful. Resolutely shitty in this performance. I don't think entirely of her own fault. I mean, I think the direction in this movie is like lead. So maybe Pafa, let's just use that name, didn't rein her in or was intimidated by an Academy Award winning performer. And then you have Bella Thorne, who's like, I don't know what the hell she thinks she's doing other than like playing everything with a straight face. It's like, if there was ever a movie where you could like take some liberties and sort of go off the deep end, this is the one, kid. But there's none of that.
Mm-hmm. It's a slog.
Yeah. It also has the most wretched editing and sound production I've ever seen and heard. Like, oh my God.
It's like student film bad.
Yeah, like there's dialogue that does, like audio that doesn't sync up. And I mean, like,
I wrote a note about this.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. But I give a wide berth to independent films. And because, you know, they're on a low budget, they have quick turnaround times, you name it. But this is just appalling. It's appallingly bad. And like I said, the edits are terrible. When she hallucinates her theater characters, which could have been cool under a much better director or editor's care or view or what have you skill. But oh my God, it just looks so cheesy and so bad. This movie was excruciating.
Yeah.
It was awful.
It really was. So
it's a very long hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a moment when, you know, so Melissa Leo's son is a famous musician who has been in and out of rehab a bunch of times. He's out of rehab. He's sober for about a month. And then he dies from, I can't remember the name of the fucking drug, but he dies from
some designer. I think it's a fake drug.
Yeah.
They call it PMA. It's some type of ecstasy like amphetamine.
Yeah. Like, but they kind of make it sound like, you know, fentanyl, basically. And so I'm still not clear as to whether he was actually poisoned by his bandmate or not, or if it's all just a coincidence. Because Bella Thorne at one point goes out of the way to say, like, and the bandmate, I don't remember his name, but the bandmate has the same brand of cigarettes that your son smoked, and he doesn't even smoke. And then you look, and he doesn't have the same brand of cigarettes. It's two fucking different boxes. I mean, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. Is Bella Thorne the one who killed them?
I kind of think that maybe she was.
I think so.
Because she had an affair with the son, you know, and then in one of the most heavy-handed of montages, she's like all hugging him, everything. And then she just sort of like leaves the frame. And then I can't remember actually what happens then. Oh, then it shows her like mixing, you know, she knows how to mix the drug so it's undetectable, because one of the plot threads is there's this Melissa Leo character that she played. It's adapted from an Edgar Allan Poe story. And I don't know if this is a real Poe story. Maybe it is. But there's this candle that somebody's put poison in, and when it burns, the poison gets released. So they do that in the movie. They like get the drug and they kill the bandmate with it.
Right. After Melissa Leo has killed several other people in kind of what I thought would be more interesting and fun ways. Like, she sets up she's directing Hamlet at this theater that's right next door to this florist who sold her son the drugs. And so she like times between her break on stage to like run over and shoot and kill him. And then she has like another time where she's like running around trying to kill someone, but it's just like she gets injured in the process. She just has no clue what the fuck she's doing. She starts a fire in the theater and they have to close her show.
My favorite thing, though, is that she's completely inept about everything, yet she thinks far enough ahead to take a stopwatch to count backward to let her know how much time she has to commit these murders before she has to be back on stage for her cue, you know?
Yep.
So it's just like, and there are other things. It's like, do we really need to see her dressing the wound on her leg? I mean, we know it's there. We know she's running out of time. You've established that because you've shown us the stopwatch about six times in close-up. So, yeah. This is another thing that I wanted to say. One about the sound. Melissa Leo goes to a rehearsal. There's going to be a benefit concert for, not a benefit, a tribute concert for her son. And there's a rehearsal and she goes and she talks. The guy's playing bass, but later you see him playing piano, the bandmate. And you can't hear their conversation because the Walla Walla is so high in the mix that all you can hear are wordless background voices. And I'm just like, seriously, did somebody just graduate from Tisch and this is their first job? I mean, what the fuck? And then the second thing that I wanted to bring up, which, of course, I can't remember right now. Well, what a terrible place to have a piano, the piano that he has in his apartment. It's like you've got that beautiful window, except you have it against the wall next to the window. Fine.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because she also is like, what a grand apartment. This is your recording studio. That's a terrible spot for a recording studio. And all there is one microphone. Like there's nothing else.
Mm-hmm. There's a couch and a piano in a relatively small living room.
You ever seen like how they record a piano? Even an upright, they use two mics. I mean, good Lord. Yeah. And then, you know, there's at the end of the movie, there's this iPhone video that Melissa Leo or maybe his dead girlfriend has taken of him performing a new unfinished song. And I hear this guy's lyrics and whoever played the guitar and this guy's singing voice. And even the most forgiving audiences would not buy this guy's shit. It is a fucking joke that he was a famous musician who could sell out places like the Gramercy Theater. You know? It's a joke. Now, I know it's a demo, and you don't always sing your best on demos. If you've ever heard any of Huey Lewis's demos, you'll know what I mean. But, like, this is laughably bad. Megan, what is it?
I was going to say, but you're totally right. And there's another scene where she's watching video of them in concert. And it's also bad. Like, it's not like that was any better than the demo. Like, it's appalling. Yeah. And if you didn't have the money or didn't have someone on the crew or the cast or whatever who could sing, then don't show those scenes. Like,
yeah.
Right.
It's just, oh my God, the ridiculously idiotic choices are just absurd.
Yeah. And I was kind of actually, I was excited when I saw Kevin Corrigan's name in the cast list because I normally really like him when he shows up. He's a fun character actor. And here he's just, his character is just such a dud and his, it's just such a bummer to see him show up in such a terrible movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, so I think Bella Thorne actually did the killing. I think. That's what you're supposed to take away from that, you know, flash sideways at the end of the movie. I don't even know what direction that flash is going. So there's that. But then there's the cop who is like the most nonchalant, like murder police I've ever seen in a movie. Just like this guy's just like, yeah, so we're working on this case and I know you're grieving, but yeah, I'll get back to you.
Yeah.
You know what's so weird about that is that guy is great as Brother Mazzone on The Wire, but he's like so like whatever here. Yeah. It's so bizarre. So bizarre.
But you get the impression that he knows that she's killed all of these people, you know?
Yes.
And obviously he can't prove it, although he could totally prove it.
Right.
Because she leaves behind enough DNA everywhere she goes. I mean, do you think she was not She wasn't bright enough to not get swiped by a gardening tool. Do you think she was smart enough to throw it away after she stole it? No.
No.
She at least took it from the scene. I mean, there was that.
That's
like,
true.
Okay, she's not the dumbest.
The only thing I was thinking was she's in costume and, you know, plausibly, you know, other people see her backstage doing whatever. It would be hard for that detective to prove that she was not in the theater between 8:17 and 8:49 or whatever it is, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's still just, I feel like, too easy. And also, by the way, when she trails the florist from like 2 feet behind him.
That is ridiculous.
That's the most amazing right. thing I've
she
ever seen.
She comes so close to getting caught.
I mean, it's one of those things where you think, you know, New York is a crowded city, but it ain't that crowded. I mean, no. So people notice when you get right up on their ass. Anybody else want to toss some gasoline on this fire? I mean,
it's just such a disappointing movie. Dave, you've used the word amateur when you and I were texting a little bit about the movie. It really just looks and sounds terrible. It's poorly edited. It doesn't do anything interesting with its idea. It's disjointed. It's completely lacking in tension and any type of, you know, get up and go when it comes to the plot. It's
the get just up and go, so get bad. Up and went.
Yeah. Indeed. So yeah, terrible movie.
You're not even afforded the opportunity to have great death scenes. I mean, they're all so corny. Mm-hmm. I mean, the best death is when the son overdoses just because you're like, oh, he's hot. Look at him putting ice on his back.
Just that's putting why ice cubes in his mouth and spitting them out.
That's why they found him in the freezer. You know, but like, I don't know. Also, I don't think that she shot the florist in a place that would kill him. She definitely shot Kevin Corrigan in a place that would kill him, like right in the neck.
The head? Yeah.
She shot that guy in the head?
Yes.
Not the gardener.
No, not the gardener. Kevin Corrigan, she shot in the head.
Yeah, she shot the gardener like the gardener, in the shoulder, yeah. I thought. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, unless it like glanced off his clavicle and entered his heart, which is possible, but we don't know that.
Right. But wouldn't he have died? Like, it would have taken longer to die than just dying instantly. Yeah.
Oh, well.
I'm just mad that I saw your guys' texts before I watched this dumpster fire of a film, because I knew going in. By the way, I had a sneaky suspicion this was going to be a terrible movie because of Bella Thorne. Yeah. Just that reason alone, I was like, I don't know. But I was like, but Melissa Leo's in it. How bad can it be? And it was even worse than I thought, somehow.
Yep. Yep.
So bad.
I want to take a measure of revenge against this fucking movie. So anyway.
Yes!
Measure of revenge. What a title. How about just revenge? Revenge. I know lots of other movies have been called that, but just...
I was going to say.
You know, there's a TV show called Revenge. There's a Kevin Costner movie mm-hmm. called Revenge. Revenge mm-hmm. of the Jedi.
Well, they could have done something funny. They could have tried to like pun off of, you know, Melissa Leo's character being an actor, you know?
Yeah.
That would have been an opportunity, but nope.
Oh, well. Well, that's Measure of Revenge, everyone. All right. Well, we'll cross that off the list, but add it to the shit list, and we'll move on to the new Pixar movie, Turning Red, which came out on Disney Plus last week. I don't know if it's in theaters or not. I don't think it is. But anyway, mm-hmm. Turning Red. This is, let me read ye old IMDb description. A 13-year-old girl named Mei Lin turns into a giant red panda whenever she gets too excited. Okay. I mean, excited. I'm going to put that in air quotes.
Hmm.
What everybody think? I mean, we can get into the plot in a minute, but...
I liked it.
I did too.
Yeah. Me three.
Yeah.
Huzzah!
Yeah, I like the fact that, you know, the main character is she's second generation Chinese Canadian, and takes place in Toronto, which I always love it when movies that are made in Canada, even though this was actually made in California, but movies that are made in Canada take place in Canada. Because, you know, a lot of times they'll be like, hey, look at the New York City skyline, Vancouver, you know, so it doesn't always work out. But this goes to great pains to like get a lot of detail about. I've been to Toronto enough times to actually recognize some things in the movie. Not a lot of things, but some. And I just really dug. Basically, this is kind of like a, what would you call it? Like a magical puberty story? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Coming of age story, magical puberty. I like it.
I mean, it's kind of like the red pandas are a real thing, by the way. I didn't know that. I was just like, red pandas.
Oh, they're adorable.
Huh? Yes, they're adorable. They're tiny. They're weeny not that little big. Creatures.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's
Evan?
Probably one.
They're like little teddy bears. I know.
They do that cute thing with their arms where they like put them up and then like fall over. But yeah, they're not big. So that's why one of the first things that surprised me about this movie is how big she was when she turned into the red panda. And then how big the mom was later when she turned into her red panda. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
It's like a kaiju film.
There was so much anime like throwback references in this with like the eyes and the fighting scenes when the pandas would be flying at each other with like the streams of light coming behind him. I was like, wow, this is like really removing itself or taking liberties with the Pixar animation, whatever, and really delving into, and I'm not like an anime expert or anything, but even I know what like anime eyes look like, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Domei Shi, the director, who is from Canada, and this is why this is a love letter to Canada. Yeah. She's a big anime fan, seems. She talked on the Ghibliotech podcast about her inspirations for this, and her short film Bao also had anime influences. But yeah, one of the great things that I really saw, like a reference that was like, holy shit, that's a great reference, is from The Girl Who Leapt Through Time. And it's a really cool visual of Mei Mei like leaping through the air when she's like trying to get to the dome to the Four Town concert. But yeah, I love that you brought that up, Dave, because there are so many great references. And it kind of reminded me, not so much thematically or even necessarily artistically, but it kind of reminded me of The Mitchells versus the Machines and how it's taking artistic liberties and doing something very different than a typical Pixar film. And I really liked that.
Yeah,
me too. I mean, I enjoy anime. I wouldn't call myself an expert by any means, but I love the stylistic influences in the animation. And I love how it portrays Toronto, too, as a city. It kind of takes on that, like, bright, glowing, nightlife kind of quality that you see in a lot of anime, where it's just, like, the city looks like such a vibrant, pulsing place with, like, a lot of life and things going on, you know, onto their own, on top of whatever our characters are up to. It's like, oh, I want to go there and I want to hang out in that city and see what's going on. It seems like there's some cool stuff and some awesome boy bands are coming to town too.
Yeah. And everybody's very polite because it's Canada. I mean, and I know that's like a, you know, a trope or a stereotype or whatever, but hang around with Canadians. I mean, just, you know, I also like, by the way, that they use Canadian words that you might not like. Instead of saying hat, they say, why are you wearing a toque, you know? And they mention the name of that they're talking about, loonies. It's like, hey, I know what a loony is. Yay.
Yep.
I didn't know they had loonies in 2002, which is when this movie takes place. Very important fact, actually. But that was cool too. Yeah, I don't really know what to say about it other than it's just really well done and really funny. And I did want Mei Mei's mother to kind of have a traditional Disney death, like fall into a chasm or some shit, because she was so awful.
But see, I didn't think she was that awful. I think I liked, well, first of all, I liked that she didn't have dead parents. But I liked that they had a mom that, even though she was overbearing, was supportive. Like, as soon as she realized that, you know, Mei Mei turned into the panda, she was chasing after her, trying to help her and support her and like try to explain what's going on to her. And I think the mother-daughter relationship is one of the movie's strengths, but also the like intergenerational relationships, like between the mom and the grandma. And like,
I love
seeing that,
the aunties, by the way.
People in your family can be overbearing and like, you know, you're not alone in that, like, you know, many kids experience the same struggle of like trying to appease or please or make their parents proud of them. And like, it's a struggle between like your own nature and your own desires and things and trying to balance that against, you know, what someone else's expectations are. And I think it's really cool that they show that both between Mei Mei and her mother, but then also her mother and her grandmother, and seeing that relationship there. I don't know. I found that really compelling, and I thought that made for a much more interesting movie, not having the dead parent trope. I was like, yay, no dead parent trope. We actually get to...
I wasn't even thinking about the dead parent trope. which is yeah, which is a Disney thing. But
yes,
I was just thinking about like accusing the friends of being, you know, influencing Maymay, and I mean, I understand why Maymay wouldn't stand up for herself in that moment. And, you know, what is a 13-year-old going to do? Like, yell at your best friend's mom? No. But, you know, going over to the convenience store and just like, I know it's supposed to set up, it raises stakes. It makes their relationship more volatile so that when the panda thing happens, there's, that's more, you know, the stake that just raises stakes. I'll leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just like, it's just like the kind of thing that really, really irritates me when you have something that's so, now what I'm about to say in the context of a movie about a girl who becomes a giant panda, but when you take something that is so absurd and you do that, and then you're expected to feel empathy for, in this case, the mother character later, although you do, ultimately, it helps greatly that the mother is played by Sandra Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I don't know who the kid is who played Maymay, but she's great.
Yeah, this is her first role, it seems. Yeah. Yeah, and she's really 16, which I think is cool because a lot of times kids don't necessarily voice act kids.
Right.
But yeah, but I agree with you, Dave. I think the voice acting is really fantastic. I hear what you're saying, Dave, about how the mom is annoying. And if... if that was my mom, I'd be like, you know, slow your roll back up. But at the same time, I'm also not a child of, you know, immigrants. I'm, yeah. You know, and Maymay gets her validation and an identity around people pleasing, specifically parent pleasing, you know, kind of what you were saying, Evan. And so, yeah, so I actually thought there was a lot more depth and nuance to their relationship, which I thought was really fascinating, even though it is kind of over the top and absurd at times. The thing that I really love about this is I love how much this centers teenage girls' perspectives, which is something that is so often chucked aside or not taken seriously or not seen as a viable perspective. And I love that her turning into a red panda is a menstruation allegory. Mm-hmm. Like, that is the fucking best. I love it. I also love that it's kind of this bestial thing. Like, it's very Ginger Snaps, like puberty, like turning into a beast. I don't know. That's just really cool. And I love that we're actually seeing, like, we don't see tampons, but we see pads on in the movie. And I think that's great. And, you know, I love that they're talking about, they don't actually talk about the raging hormones, but that's what they're essentially alluding yeah. to is, you know, the hormones of puberty, mm-hmm. the, you know, first crushes, yeah. loving bands, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, so many teenagers, especially at that time, loved boy bands, and it's great to see that. And like, I can't not talk about the atrocious film review that came out of Cinema Blend, and they ended up taking it down because it was such an offensive review, talking about how this movie was not relatable in any way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. except to the four, you know, female friends. And it's ridiculous because it's like, why are they not relatable? Because Maymay's Chinese Canadian, because they're teenage girls, because they like boy bands, like because she's undergoing puberty and her period, like mm-hmm. it's just such bullshit. Yeah. So anyway, I really appreciated this. And even though I'm not from Canada, I'm not, you know, Chinese Canadian or Chinese American, I did not love boy bands at that age. I went in a very different direction, but that's a whole other thing. I really could relate to this though. I could relate to those crushes and relate to feeling, you know, weird, you know, because of the hormones and your body's changing and everything. So yeah, I just thought this was really well done and really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. For me, I think it did work a little bit because I was coming of age at that time. I was a few years older, but like, I don't know. I remember that period where it was just like boy bands were the thing. And I think they did a really good job of creating a boy band that sounded like a boy band of the era and felt believable. Mm-hmm. And I just think they did such a good job of like recreating that like early aughts like boy band sound. And I love the line where I think her mom says something like, why are they called Four Town? There's five of them. And it just, it always makes me think of that line from Airheads where Joe Montana goes, You guys are called the Lone Rangers?
Yeah.
You're not exactly lone. There are three of you.
Yeah. You know, it's a great line. I was just thinking about the Cinema Blend review, which I heard about but didn't read. I don't know how much you need to read when you know that the crux is like, I don't like girls because I'm an old dude or what, however old the fucking guy is. But the thing that's funny about it was, like, in 2002, I worked at a record store, right? So, or actually, no, that's not true. I had left the record store by then, but I had worked in a record store during the boy band craze. Like, I was there when Black and Blue came out and when whatever the NSYNC album was that came out. And we were open till 1 a.m. so that on Tuesday at midnight, you could come get your fucking whatever. And so I know, like, hearing... like listening to 4Town was like listening to Backstreet Boys to me. Like, sounded so much like them, so perfect.
Yeah.
And I completely, although it's not my favorite kind of music, some of that shit isn't bad. I mean, I'm not gonna fucking front about that shit.
It's catchy. Yeah.
But I certainly understand the frame of mind of the fans of that music just because I saw them in person. I mean, it's so crazy. It's like, are you going to say that like 13-year-old girls when the Beatles landed at JFK are not relatable? I mean, because it was like this new fad that nobody had heard of? I mean, Jesus Christ. Stupid.
But that's, you're so right, Dave, but that's the thing. I feel like history has been rewritten and people forget that it was 13-year-old girls who going wild for the Beatles. That's partly what put them on the map. Like, people think about like, oh, music rose,
yeah, you know,
elevating them anyway. But yeah, it's so absurd. But yeah, anyway. But yeah, I have to say, I love the songs too. And I love that Billie Eilish co-wrote them. And I also love that Jordan Fisher is one of the singers in the boy band. And he is Seahawk on She-Ra. And he's great. And I love him.
Oh yeah, I love Seahawk. Seahawk's so such great. A fun character.
I know, it is sea shanties.
Yeah,
it's so great. It is. Yeah, this movie's really adorable. This movie, I don't know, did you guys also get really emotional at the end? I cried at the end.
I got really emotional.
Which part though?
That's a great question. I mean, I started getting emotional when the ceremony was happening and Mei Mei realizes she doesn't want to give up the panda, and then when they're doing it again for the mom and she sees her mom crying, and I'm like, this is a very petite maman moment where it's like Mei Mei is a child and she sees her mom as a child. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just so moving, and it was so, and oh, it's just so sad.
I did find that moving when she found her, you know, 16-year-old mother crying in the forest. And then 13-year-old her had to, because I'm just assuming that her mother was like 16, because for one thing, she became a panda. Her father says at one point when they were dating, because grandma did not approve of him. So I'm like, all right, well, they got, unless she married like her eighth grade crush, or this, they would say in Canada, grade eight crush, you know, probably she was a little older when the panda magic happened for her. But I found that moment really touching and may have shed many, many tears. And I also liked that, just like you were saying, that Mei Mei decided she's like, she's keeping the panda. Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I loved that too. And I liked seeing the juxtaposition of the previous generations, you know, seeing it as a curse, or as they call it, an inconvenience as opposed to a blessing, which is what, you know, the first of their ancestors to become the red panda felt, that, you know, she could become this creature to protect her people. And so I kind of love that we see the juxtaposition of, you know, the elders in her family see it as a curse. They trap their panda away in these charms, but she sees it as this like beautiful thing that she shares with other people. And like, she ends up monetizing the panda, and they like use it to buy the concert tickets. But, you know, it's like she's taking photos and all the kids at school have the t-shirts, and the, you know, it's just, there's something really sweet about her embracing it. Embracing her heritage, and then also just saying, no, I want this. I'm not going to shy away from this. I'm going to lean into it.
Yeah. I also, for a quick moment, want to talk about the three best friends, who are, I think, the most, strange to say for an animated movie, I guess, like some of the most accurately portrayed, it's an accurately portrayed friend group. These four 13-year-olds who love each other so much that they're like, well, if you can't go to the concert, you can have my ticket. I know so many so kids who would have done that. And then when they're finally like, no, you can take my ticket. I'll stay home. And then, you know, the one who's got the braces, whose name I can't remember, Miriam, she's like, no, none of us is going to the concert if, you know, May May can't go. And it's just like, yeah, man, rock and roll. You guys are the real thing, you know?
Yeah, their solidarity is so sweet. Yeah. So lovely.
I also like that one of them is a total deadpan Priya. She's just like, never changes expression. I thought that was really funny.
That's cute. Mm-hmm.
Well, any closing thoughts on Turning Red, gang?
I mean, it was really good. I'm glad I watched it. And I don't know. I was looking through my notes and I just saw, I like gyrating. I'm 13. Deal with it. That was just such a funny scene when she was, you know, like dirty dancing as the panda to like make her mom angry. I just thought that was so fucking funny.
That was kind of funny that her butt was her weapon against her mother, you know, when they were having their panda fight. So anyway, yeah, I really dug Turning Red and I would recommend it too. So
yeah, sweet film.
On to the last movie of the eve, Deep Water. This is not about a mining accident.
It's not a Doobie Brothers song either.
That's Blackwater.
Nope. Roll Blackwater.
Keep on rolling. Now, Adrian Lyne or Lynn or whatever hasn't made a movie in 20 years, right?
That's correct. Unfaithful was his last.
And so this is starring Ben Affleck, and Ana de Armas, and Tracy Letts. And it's based on a Patricia Highsmith novel directed by, like I said, Adrian Lyne. I don't know which it is. Here's your one sentence thing on IMDb. A well-to-do husband who allows his wife to have affairs in order to avoid a divorce becomes a prime suspect in the disappearance of her lovers. Accurate.
Yes.
Accurate-ish.
Sure.
In and of itself, not a bad idea for a movie. In execution.
Yeah. This was also a slog for me. Yeah. It was rough.
The one thing that I think works for it, and I can't believe I'm saying this, we talked about this a little bit, Evan, is how much Ben Affleck just seems to be enjoying himself. He's just you know... as an actor, he's just like, I'm just playing a shithead and I like it, you know?
He seems to be having fun. And I was saying to Dave, I'm glad one of us was, because this movie, otherwise, like, there's not much that I can cling to. But I was really enjoying watching Ben Affleck have so much fun playing the villain, playing this just quietly menacing, but also just like so scary, you know? Jealous, murderous husband.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting that you guys think he's having so much fun, because I thought he looked tortured through this. And I don't think there's anything fun about this. I wish, because I love Ben Affleck as an actor.
I didn't say it was fun. Also really... I said he was fun.
Yeah.
Sorry. He was having fun.
But you said that you latched on. Evan said he latched on to his fun performance. So that's what I was referring to. Thank you. That's what I was referring to. But no, and I'm glad that you were able to latch on to that, because I wasn't. Because Ben Affleck has played this role before, not exactly, but a similar role in Gone Girl. And he's great. He's so great in that. And he's so great as a shithead. And he's so awesome. And yes, I like him as a villain. I think he's really good at it. Oh, but this film, oh my God, no. No, this film is just, by the way, for an erotic thriller, and,
this
you know,
is supposed
this
to be
is not
erotic?
The age of erotic thrillers.
Yes.
Yes, this is supposed to be an erotic psychological thriller. Mm-hmm. And that's what Adrian Lyne or Lyne has, you know, built his career
Fatal
on.
Attraction.
What
was that?
Indecent Proposal. Yep. Indecent Proposal. Fatal Attraction. Unfaithful.
Weeks.
Like, yep. And also did Flashdance, but that's not an erotic thriller. But it is. There are erotic scenes in it. It is supposed to be sexy dancing. And for someone who has that kind of career, I was expecting a lot more eroticism or sexiness, especially from a couple who were a real life couple. And this is the most anemic, sexless movie, despite
anemic,
all of the sex.
Good word. Mm.
Thank you. But yeah, this is, I mean, this movie is soulless. It is lifeless. It is like, I didn't give a shit about what was happening or who was killing whom or what was going on. And I was just like, and Tracy Letts deserves better. Ana de Armas deserves better. She's great in Knives Out. Mm-hmm. Ben Affleck deserves better. I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah.
This was just, my suspicion is Sam Levinson, because Sam Levinson is not a good writer, except when he's writing about addiction, then he's great. Cause the episodes of Euphoria that focus on addiction, really fantastic. But my big suspicion is that a part of it is cause he's one of the writers who adapted Patricia Highsmith's novel. And yeah, but also just, yeah. I don't know what's happening with this movie.
I said this to Evan off mic, and I'll let you in on what I was thinking, is this movie has two fundamental problems that sink it from the beginning. The first one is that it's not good.
That is a fundamental problem.
The second problem, though, and this actually supersedes the first one, which is I feel like at this point in life, when you're or in existence, human existence, whatever, if you're going to adapt Patricia Highsmith, you need to set it in the era it was written so that the social mores that exist in this movie don't seem so hopelessly outdated.
Just
update it to contemporary things. It's just like...
Right.
So this guy invented a microchip that like is great for drone technology for, you know, killing terrorists or suspected terrorists or whatever. And that's why he doesn't have to work anymore. And he doesn't divorce his cheating wife because it would be too costly. I mean, that's just stupid. It's just stupid. And the idea that she would just like stick around and just be the trophy wife when that's just clearly not what she wants. It doesn't actually seem like she really cares about the money all that much either.
Yeah.
And even if she did,
or him,
or anything.
And even if she did, assuming there were no prenups or postnups, she'd get half of everything anyway. So what is the problem? What is the problem?
So that's so I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's what I kept thinking watching it. But I feel like, and you're right about this should have been set in the era it was written. So it should have been set in the 50s. Or you're right, it should have been updated. And I was like, you know, this could have been a really interesting exploration of a poly relationship, an open marriage.
Yeah.
It could have been really interesting. Like, what happens when you open up a marriage, when you have, you know, poly relationships, but one person is really hyper jealous and can't handle it? Like, that's a legit problem. That is a real thing that happens. And that could have been really fascinating. But the movie doesn't go there. The movie doesn't give a shit about that. And all it wants to do is essentially slut shame Melinda and make her the spicy Latina trope, which is awful. Because she has no personality outside of wanting to fuck every single guy.
Be drunk.
She wants to fuck a lot of guys.
Be drunk all the time, right? And not pay attention to her kid. Like that's not a character. That's a cipher. That's a trope. Mm-hmm. It's nothing. But the thing of it is I think, and also I keep coming back to Sam Levinson because he did Malcolm and Marie, which is such a ripoff of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. All I kept thinking watching this is that this film thinks it's smarter than it is. It's trying to be Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's trying to be Phantom Thread. It's trying to be Gone Girl. It's trying to have this really fascinating marital conflict where they're playing mind games with each other and having, you know, vicious, scathing, throwdown verbal barbs. But it doesn't actually ever deliver on that. And that's the problem. So you keep coming back to, what the hell is the point? Why are they married to each other? And it's just the fact that he is like, oh, I don't want to question her decisions. I want her to live her life. But that's such a crock of shit, because he's going around taking credit for murdering her former lover and then actually murdering her lovers. Like, it's just, oh my God.
Did he drown the guy? Do we know that he did that?
Yeah, he did.
Why do you think that?
Yeah, the first guy, I should say, because that's what happens in the book.
Okay.
So that's why I thought that. But yeah, but the first guy, the Martin McRae guy, no, I don't think he does kill him, because he says he kills him. He says it twice to Joel, but then he says he beat him with a hammer or whatever, or hit him with a hammer.
Right.
But as you hear on the news, he was shot. So I'm like, oh, he didn't really kill that guy. He's just taking credit
for it.
Yeah,
I was wondering if Melinda had killed him, because I think that would have been interesting.
Oh,
it was like he was taking credit,
that
or she like accidentally killed him because she was drunk or whatever. That would have been more interesting than the movie became. There were a couple things that I got really hung up on this movie First was when they go to the party and their kid is there, and then they're driving home and she goes to give him a blowjob while he's driving. What the fuck happened to their kid? Their kid's not in the back seat. Where's their kid?
She was at that party?
They didn't take the kid to the party.
No, the kid was at the party. And then they were like driving home after the party. Because the kid was sitting with them on the swing while they were talking to Tracy Letts. And then she gets up and runs away to go play. And then they're on their way home and she's just not there anymore.
Oh, I thought that was a different party. There were so many parties in this movie.
So many parties. And then the other thing that really got hung up on was this idea that the bank calls him about a lack of funds in one of his accounts, yes. Which makes no sense. This guy's filthy fucking rich. Why would they be calling him about lack of funds in his account? And then on top of that, why would they be charging him a $50 overdraft fee when he would clearly be the kind of banking customer that would either not have a fee or would have such a low fee? Like a $50 fee is for someone like with like a way worse account at the bank. It's just like there's so many parts about that just didn't make sense to me.
Okay, I have to get bank technical for a moment. Usually the fee is not that high, but aside from the fee part, the fact that he was getting a call from the bank, that depending on the kind of bank, because there are banks out there that cater specifically to millionaire clients that might do that and call and say, hey, there's insufficient funds in your account. Do you want us to transfer or whatever? But so I hear you, but that wasn't actually my problem. My problem was, why the hell is the banker talking about a transaction Melinda did? Mm-hmm. Like, that was what was creepy. But anyway, maybe they have a joint account, but still, it was weird.
Yeah.
But yes, it was. I love that we're getting into the minutiae of the banking. Well, this film.
Me too, because it was just such an odd. It was clearly there because it had to be for the plot and not because, you know, to Dave's point, it takes place in present day where he would have gotten an email or a text message about the situation, probably, and would have seen whatever was going on, not him having to be on the phone and have someone say, there's a suspicious charge of $3,000 paid to piano player guy, whatever the fuck his name is.
Charlie Line or Charlie Lynn. I've actually gotten phone calls from my bank, so I get calls about suspicious transactions sometimes.
Yeah, I've opted into all those after my identity was almost stolen. But
yeah.
The other thing here, I have another question.
Yes, I love it.
So at the end, we've killed lover number 3 with a rock to the head. And then we've not weighed his body down well enough. I mean, this is a raging river. All rivers lead to the sea, but you don't want to take the chance that he'll wash up on a rock. You weigh him down, whatever. Do it better, first of all. Second of all, why is Tracy Letts there looking for the scarf? Why?
So I got the sense
he was just following him.
What's her face? Melinda called him and told him. But here's the thing. That's what I was thinking when he was there. I was like, oh, she must have called him because she's trying to like catch him or whatever. But then she burns the license from her former lover to like cover up that he murdered him. So I'm like, this doesn't make sense. So it comes back to, yes, Dave, you're 100% right. Why was Tracy Letts there?
Other than to drive like an idiot down the hill.
Yeah.
That was the stupidest driving I've ever seen in my life.
And he's also trying to text while furiously driving when he can easily use Siri and make a phone call. Like, he didn't even need to die so stupidly.
Hey Siri, but dial 911.
He doesn't know that.
But I don't know. I think there was that scene where we found out that Melinda and the Tracy Letts character had a private investigator, you know, following him around, and they were in cahoots and accusing him of murder. So I think, Megan, you might be right. She probably found the wallet, called Tracy Letts. He went over there and that, you know, he found the scarf on his way and then was like, I'll probably catch him doing some shady shit while I'm there.
Right. Right. Totally. But then why did she burn the license at the end? Like, that's what I can't figure out. Like, so you want to leave, you're going to leave, you're going to pack your suitcase and you're going to take your daughter. By the way, your daughter, who is unhinged, who knows that her father is committing murders, but she's not mad about that. She's mad he was not honest about it. Then he's giving her booze at 5 years old. This is also weird. And then the daughter freaks out and she's like, we're not leaving. So then you're going to listen to your 5 year old and then and stay with a murderer. Like, it just doesn't make sense. This movie's absurd. And not in a good fun way.
Yeah.
No, in a slow, painful way.
Yes. Ben Affleck, you deserve better. Actually, everybody in this film deserves better.
This movie is a distinct POS. Yeah.
It is. It is. I mean, and then there's just the relationships between all their friends in the movie are like weird and confusing. You don't, you're like, how do any of these people know each other? Why did they hang out? Why is Lil Rel one of his best friends and seems like, he seems like a mafia guy. Like his two friends seem like they're like his capos and like they like follow him around and like do his dirty work. And you're like, why? But for what? I don't understand how they know each other. I don't understand why they're so serious all the time and why they're just like, what is going on in this movie?
That's such a great point. I also don't understand, thinking back to the beginning of the film, you know, his friends are coming up to him and are like, oh, you know, Melinda, she's flaunting her affections and she's flirting with all these guys and she's probably fucking them. Like, who knows what she's doing? He could have very easily said, you know, like, oh, we have an arrangement, you know, like, or, oh, we have, you know, we have a partially open marriage or whatever. But again, no, he doesn't say that. And, you know, maybe he's private, whatever. But again, none of that is ever addressed. It's never, he never says, like, oh, we have an unconventional relationship or whatever. Like, it's just, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense.
And, you know, what you were saying before, like, that could, it could have been an opportunity. Okay, they said they were going to open up their marriage. He said he was fine with it. The more he sees them, the more he's not fine with it. And he grows into a murderous rage because of it. Not just we're operating at a point where he's just clearly not on board with it from the start. And with it seems there was no talk. It just happens.
No, film critic Layla Latif had a great tweet about this film, and she talked about when a film is so heavy-handed, and I think she said lazy, where they use a person's job as character development, and the fact that, you know, he's making a microchip for drones, like, is that supposed to be the tip-off that he's a shitbag of a guy?
Like, I have no idea.
But, like, rather than actually delving into his character, like, oh, God. And all I kept thinking with that scene when Tracy Letts and Ben Affleck are debating drones is I'm like, oh, this film thinks it's smart. So much smarter than it is. Because it's not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I'm thinking about the episode of The Simpsons where Sideshow Bob keeps stepping on all the rakes. I don't know. Well, have we shot the moon on ye old deep river?
I don't understand a lot of the choices in this movie.
Yeah. Evan, how about you? You good?
Yeah, I think I've said all I need to say or asked the questions aloud that I needed to ask after watching this movie.
I now almost feel like I need to go back and see about the kid if she's at the party, but I'm like, no, I don't want to go back and watch it.
Don't do that to yourself.
But Evan, that's like, oh my God, that's bad. That's some terrible editing.
Right, it's
like,
bad continuity.
Yes.
By the way, I also love the fucking like NDA I had to sign to not talk about this movie until I guess it would technically be yesterday because this podcast comes out on Friday. I mean, good Lord.
Mm-hmm. You can only watch this movie in a dark room by yourself in the corner of your house with no one else to be able to hear or see or know that you're watching this movie.
I don't think anybody else would want to know that I was hearing, seeing, or watching this movie. They'd be like, why are you watching this piece of shit? What's wrong with you? I don't care that this is your job. You're an idiot. You know, so. All right.
Yeah, it was like when you start reviewing a lot of Disney movies or Hulu movies, all the Disney house, you sign those NDAs.
Well, gang, that is yet another episode of Spoiler Piece Theater. Just run through this real quick. We all definitely do not recommend Measure of Revenge, even as a gag. This movie is coming out in theaters, which blows my mind. So you can see it in theaters. Turning Red is out right now on Disney Plus, and Deep Water is, for better or worse, on Hulu. And I think we're a yay on Turning Red and a nay on Deepwater. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Okay,
that is good. Correct.
Okay, well, I want to say thank you to our editor, Otto Klammer. Thank you, Otto, for taking care of the heavy lifting each week, especially last week with episode 400, which was long. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Otto.
Thanks, Otto.
If you want to get a little more spoiler piece action in your heart, please subscribe or follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to read more about us, you can go to our website, spoilerpiece.com. You can also find our merch link there for Tee Public, Spoiler Piece merch. Yay. You can find us on social media, Spoiler Piece Theater on Facebook, at Spoiler Piece on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. If you'd like to get in touch with us and disagree wildly about either Measure, I want to call it Master of Revenge now for some reason, Measure of Revenge or Deepwater. You guys should be in Deepwater because that movie's great. Anyway, you can email us, spoilerpiece@gmail.com, or you could give us a call
at 862-21-PIECE.
And you could leave us a voicemail and tell us what you think about these movies or any other movies or anything else that's on your mind, movie related or merch related. Let us know what you think of the t-shirts.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ooh, please do. Mm-hmm.
If you like the show, please consider rating and reviewing us by going to ratethispodcast.com/spoilerpiece, or you can rate us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. That really helps us out. Every time there's a rating or a review, peeps are more likely to hear about us. So that would be grand if you did that. And if you really, really like the show, please join our Patreon. Again, I will mention that this week we're talking about Return of the Jedi, which, oh man, we had so much fun talking about Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. For $5 a month, you get extra weekly audio that is only for you and other patrons, and you get to vote in monthly polls, and it's a hoot, and we would really love it if you joined. Patreon is thinking of the Return of the Jedi conversation this week, I just had so much fun. I love the Patreon stuff, so thank you so much, patrons. I just wanted to add that.
Patreon is a blast.
Yeah. My name is Dave Riedel. I write about movies. I'm a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association, and you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd as Dave Sees Movies.
My name is Evan Crean. I'm co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of Your 80s Movie Guide to Better Living. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd as Real Recon, and that's real as in film reel.
And my name is Megan Kearns. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network. I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association. You can follow me on Twitter at OpinionSWorld or on Instagram and Letterboxd at TheOpinionS.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.